Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. WITF Smart Talk continues our coverage of the coronavirus COVID-19 outbreak over the next week or so. On today's program, we start with, you know, we've seen a lot of examples out there across the country of Americans' compassionate willingness to help others during the coronavirus pandemic, whether it be offering to care for a child, pick up groceries, or buy takeout from a local restaurant. But unfortunately, there are those who are taking advantage of the situation by jacking up prices on essentials like sanitizer or even toilet paper. There are also scams being perpetrated as well. Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro has set up a tip line to report price gouging, and unfortunately, it's been busy. Attorney General Shapiro, welcome to the program.
Scott, good to be with you this morning.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Attorney General, I know you're not a doctor, but I'm going to ask this question anyway. Is there a cure or a vaccine for COVID-19?
Not at this time, and the experts I know are working overtime on this to try and advance it to the market as quickly as possible. And I know there have been some human tests done, but that process is going to take some time. That's not going to get us out of the current situation we're in. What is going to help us in the current situation we're in is obviously to heed the governor's warnings and make sure that people are not only social distancing, but really trying to stay home and limit any sort of external travel. And also making sure that we get these test sites set up across Pennsylvania and across the country and test people to make sure we know who has it, and those who do have it need to quarantine and limit their exposure, especially to older Pennsylvanians.
Well, there was a reason I asked that question. So anyone selling a product...
Scott, I assume there's a reason why you ask all your questions.
But so anyone selling a product that claims to cure or maybe even be a vaccine is defrauding consumers and trying to take advantage of them during a time when people are afraid, correct?
Right, that's correct. Anyone purporting to suggest that they have a vaccine, they're lying to you. They're scamming you. As for, you know, what medicines might be helpful if you come down with COVID-19, I'm going to leave that between the patient and the doctor. I'm not going to interfere with that conversation.
Televangelist Jim Baker was touting a cure product and has been shut down by your colleague in Missouri, the Attorney
Right.
General's office in Missouri. Have we had any cases in Pennsylvania that you're aware of someone hawking a miracle cure?
No, and I'm aware of that case. And anyone who purports to be a spiritual leader and then spew lies and nonsense like that and take advantage of people's fears doesn't feel very spiritual to me. What it is just a, you know, a low rate, you know, scammer out there. I will just tell you that we've not seen that example of scams in Pennsylvania. We've seen a lot of price gouging. I know we're going to talk about that, but we've not seen that type of scam. But anyone suggesting that they've got a cure, whether it's a so-called religious leader or some business person or someone you hear about on the internet, don't buy it. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Well, let's talk about price gouging. There are certain products that have been hoarded during this whole episode over the past week or so. Products like toilet paper and hand sanitizer. But before we get into whether we have cases, how many have been reported here in Pennsylvania, how do you define price gouging?
Sure. So let's separate out the conversation between hoarding and price gouging, and let's focus on answering your question about price gouging. First off, price gouging is a legal term. And when the governor declared his disaster just a few days ago, that triggered certain laws in the Commonwealth, or triggered the activation of provisions of those laws in the Commonwealth, one of which is the Pennsylvania Price Gouging Act, which says that if a wholesaler, distributor, retailer is charging an unconscionably excessive price, then my office, the Office of Attorney General, has the authority to go after that and ultimately shut them down if need be. Now, the next question is, well, what does it mean to be unconscionably excessive in price? The legal definition is if those consumer goods exceed 20% of the average price sold over the seven preceding days. Now, I don't want Pennsylvanians to worry about the legal definition. That's what we're here for. But what I do want Pennsylvanians to do is to alert us if they think there's price gouging going on. And then once we receive that tip, we'll go to work and we'll take it from there. And we could talk more about the complaints we've received and the great way Pennsylvanians have responded to help us combat price gouging in Pennsylvania.
So what did you do to try to fight price gouging here in Pennsylvania?
As soon as the governor issued his declaration, we set up a hotline. We figured given that people were going to be in a position where they could communicate with us largely via email and phone, we set up an email hotline, and it's pricegouging@attorneygeneral.gov. Pricegouging@attorneygeneral.gov. And as of a few moments ago, we have received 1,007 total complaints about pricing. And just to give you a sense, that number stood at 757 just 24 hours ago. So the number of cases coming into our special email hotline are growing rapidly, and we follow up on each and every one of those complaints that we receive.
How do you do that, Mr. Attorney General? 1,007 reports. How do you follow up on each and every one?
Well, first off, when we saw this coming, we set up remote working structures for the Office of Attorney General. So our Bureau of Consumer Protection is able to work from home, is able to do what we need to do in order to follow up. And here's what we actually do. We contact the business, we contact the distributor, the wholesaler, and we tell them we're aware of this pricing issue and to cut it out. Now, typically what happens is they will stop their price gouging, or they will provide us information as to why it's not price gouging. If a business is uncooperative with us, then we issue cease and desist letters. And we have issued so far 28 cease and desist letters. It doesn't mean that all the other complaints are not price gouging. It just means we had to go to that next level on those particular businesses. But what I'm really trying to do is, rather than getting into a legal fight back and forth, I'm trying to get these businesses to correct their behavior. And we've got numerous examples of that. We had a big box retailer in Philadelphia, who was selling a gallon of water, which was normally 99 cents. They had upcharged that to $1.69 right after the state of emergency. We contacted them. We actually sent a cease and desist letter, and then they lowered their price back down. Then we had a smaller retailer in Whitehall, Pennsylvania, where hand sanitizer was being sold typically for $2, and they jacked that price up to $19.99. We issued a cease and desist letter, and they immediately lowered the price to within an acceptable range. But then we have a pharmacy in Montgomery County, where I'm from, that continues to charge a ludicrous $25 for a mask in Montgomery County. And we, in that case, are going to have to fight them legally because they are unwilling to change their behavior. But by and large, we're finding that merchants across Pennsylvania, when they're called on it, thanks to the help of Pennsylvania consumers who are issuing these tips, we're able to bring those prices right down.
Well, the $1.69 for the 99-cent bottle of water doesn't sound outrageous, but it does rise above that 20% range.
Correct.
That they were talking about. But the other examples you gave, especially with the mask, since we've been told that for the most part, that we don't need masks, it's not going to protect you against it. Plus, those in the medical profession need those masks. So there's a couple different things going on there. So is it when you say that they cease and desist, you send a cease and desist to them, is that actually a criminal charge or is it?
No.
It's a civil.
It's a civil action, and it brings with it, ultimately, if they fail to comply, a $10,000 per violation fine. So if you're selling toilet paper for $39.99, as was the case with one merchant in Philadelphia, that's a $10,000 fine for the toilet paper. It would also be a $10,000 fine for another item, hand sanitizer, bleach, whatever. And so we take that very seriously, and we will fine these merchants if they don't comply. And again, I want to be clear about something. It's not just the individuals going to the store to buy the product. If the stores themselves are being price gouged by wholesalers or distributors, we will protect our business community in Pennsylvania as well from those, the wholesalers or distributors. So price gouging can work in a number of different ways, and we're focused on combating all of it.
Has it happened that wholesalers have tried to gouge retailers?
We've received complaints about that, and we're following up on that.
Mm. What product? I mean, it was pretty outrageous, the one you just listed of the $40 roll of toilet paper package of toilet paper.
It was a package.
So it was a four-pack. Are there? What was the most outrageous example that you've heard so far?
Look, there's so many. I mean, $20 for a thing of Purell, $25 for a mask. I mean, look, here's the bottom line. At a time when people are struggling to figure this world of uncertainty out and how they're going to put food on the table and take care of their kids and keep their elderly parents safe, you know, gouging the prices of basic necessities like cleaning supplies and hand soap and toilet paper it's not just illegal, but it's indecent. And folks who do that are alienating themselves from the community, and they're going to find themselves in legal trouble with the Office of Attorney General. And so, you know, now's a time where we've got to be watching out for our neighbors, where we've got to be putting greed ahead, put greed behind the greater good, and focus on looking out for one another and lending a helping hand to friends and neighbor, particularly those friends and neighbors who work as first responders or work in the healthcare industry who need our help right now so they can go out and do their job to help the rest of us. So we got to just appeal to people's better angels and focus on doing the right thing. And I will say that I'm heartened by just the vast, vast, vast majority of Pennsylvanians doing just that. But for those who try to cut corners, for those who act greedy, for those who violate our laws, we're not resting and we're not taking days off during this. And we're focused every bit as much on keeping Pennsylvanians safe and protecting them from things like price gouging.
Attorney General Shapiro, I know that vengeance is not part of your job, but I'm sure there are people out there who would like to know who these retailers are that are price gouging, because it could hurt their business in the long run. But, I mean, do you publicize it when someone has been a cease and desist has been ordered against them?
Once we go through that cease and desist process and violations are attached, then there'll be some public recognition. But as of right now, that's not what we're doing. That's not the focus of our efforts. The focus of our efforts is getting them to correct their behavior.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've been talking about a lot of retailers. What about online retailers?
Same thing. It doesn't matter to us whether you're a big box retailer, a small corner store, or you're online. If you are price gouging, we're going to hold you accountable. We've been in regular communication with Amazon, for example, the largest marketplace in the world. And I will say that they've stepped up their efforts to try to combat price gouging on their platform. So that's one example of an online platform that we're working with.
Mm-hmm. Governor Wolf, I want to change gears for just a moment. Governor Wolf strongly encouraged non-essential businesses to shut down yesterday. Now, some with state licenses can be controlled, that order can be, that they would have to shut down under the governor's order, but others can't. Any repercussion for a business that stays open?
The governor has indicated that he wants local law enforcement to, quote unquote, police the shutdown. And I'm deferring to the governor's wishes on that, and local authorities I know are stepping up. I think this is the kind of situation where you want to avoid as much as possible big legal confrontations. And instead, you want to have conversations with folks. People are on edge. People are worried. They're worried financially. They're worried about their health. I understand that anxiety, and I think the best way to address that is by having communication with people, helping them understand that, hey, you know what? I know you feel like you need to stay open. I realize that these are challenging economic times, but by you shutting down, you're actually helping us stop the spread of the virus and allowing us to get on with our normal daily lives more quickly. And the people that I've spoken with, the people that I've seen are heeding the governor's warnings, understanding that they've got a role to play in this process. And I think that's the best course. I think the governor has laid it out effectively, and I think he's doing a very effective job.
Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Attorney General Shapiro, thank you very much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, and thank you for your work to get the word out on this. And just if I can, as we close here, if anyone out there feels like they are being price gouged, contact us right away at pricegouging@attorneygeneral.gov, and we'll go to work for you. Thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Just want to give you an update, a programming update here on WITF. President Trump has scheduled an announcement press conference for 10:30 this morning, and I think you heard reported that the president is supporting an $850 billion economic stimulus package. I'm sure that will come up as part of the announcement, and that will be live here on WITF coming up at 10:30 this morning. We're not going to go to 1A. We will go right after Smart Talk. We will go back to Morning Edition for the latest news, and then pick up the president's press conference coming up at 10:30 this morning. Live radio, and we're responding to all the things, news happening fast, and we're trying to keep you updated as much as possible. But this will be an important, at least economic news coming from the president coming up at 10:30 this morning. Late last week on Smart Talk, we received a call from a dentist who said that he had been not given a lot of guidelines by the state for dealing with the coronavirus. You know, it's been a few days. Did that dentist know what to do? Should you even keep your dental appointments? Joining us now is Dr. Charles Inkakateria, who is the president of the Pennsylvania Dental Association. Dr. Inkakateria, welcome to the program.
Scott, I appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to speak to you this morning.
If you have a question or a comment of a dental nature about your teeth, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. That's 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Inkakateria, want to ask you about those updates that from the state. Have you gotten anything over the weekend or since like Friday? What dentists in Pennsylvania are supposed to do?
Yes, absolutely. So there were a number of dental associations throughout the country over this weekend that were making decisions whether or not their dentist office should continue to practice or to close and only see emergencies, et cetera. The Pennsylvania Dental Association made the stand that we don't have the resources to make those decisions. We don't have access to the scientific community that the American Dental Association has. And so as we were trying to field questions from our members, we were telling everybody that we are waiting for guidance from the American Dental Association. And so the American Dental Association Board of Trustees met over the weekend. They met again by phone conference yesterday around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And the American Dental Association came out with a statement that we're supporting for our members of the Pennsylvania Dental Association, that elective dentistry should be delayed for 3 weeks, and that patients should seek emergency care in their dental offices. The one issue that I have with that on a personal level is that the ADA has not defined what elective dentistry is. And so we're trying to seek information from the ADA on what that definition means. And the reason I say that is because decay is something that doesn't go away, okay, and decay progresses. Now, what level of decay do we say to a patient, this is elective dentistry, or no, it needs to be seen right now? You know, obviously, as the decay gets closer to the nerve of the tooth, there's a higher danger of the patient developing an abscess and creating an emergency. And so should we be seeing these patients now and continuing to provide care as we normally do, or should we delay care up to 3 weeks or longer? There's a lot of questions out there. There was a lot of angst among many members. Obviously, this affects not only their health and the health of their staff and their families, but also the economics behind their dental practices. We have a lot of young dentists who are coming out of schools with huge amounts of debts. You know, over $280,000 is the average debt that a dental student comes out of school with. And to curtail their practices, obviously, is going to be difficult. And I just heard you talking about the president speaking at 10:30 today. You know, we're waiting to find out what kind of financial relief, not necessarily for just the dentists, but also for our staff members if we have to furlough them. So although the ADA has come out with this statement, it's still a little bit of unclear of what exactly we should be doing in our offices.
Well, you know, you anticipated my next question because I was going to ask you to define elective. That would seem to be a pretty big question. In your mind, what is elective?
So, you know, there's certain things in dentistry that certainly, you know, there's dentists that are doing cosmetic dentistry. Okay, you know, putting veneers on teeth just to change the shape and color and make them, you know, prettier and such like that. There are some dental practices that actually perform Botox and dermal fillers and such like that. You know, those things obviously are elective. But again, you know, if somebody has gum disease and they're a diabetic and there's been a great research on the link between, for example, gum disease and diabetes and heart disease, you know, do we delay treatment for those patients or do we continue on so that we're sure that their health is not compromised? And so, you know, obviously things that are cosmetic, maybe placing an implant, maybe that's something that could be delayed for a few weeks because that's not necessarily a, you know, absolutely necessary treatment to be done. But in my own practice, I'm trying to continue on. If a patient has decay, I feel that they should be treated. You know, if it's a small area of decay, I could see delaying that for a couple of weeks. But if I'm seeing decay that's getting into the dentin, the layer underneath the enamel, I feel that I should be treating those patients personally. So I'm at a little bit of a conflict with what the ADA is saying, and I'm looking for more guidance from them.
I would think that pain would be a good barometer, too, that if a patient is in pain, okay, a toothache, decay that, you know, when they eat, they are in some pain. Is that a good indicator?
Absolutely. Anybody that's having any kind of pain should definitely be seeing their dentist. They should not delay their care. And I just want to make it clear. I will tell you, I graduated dental school in 1982, so I'm a little bit older. And when I was a resident at Lehigh Valley Hospital, that's when this whole HIV crisis occurred. And before, when I graduated dental school, we didn't wear masks and gloves, and we didn't use high-level disinfection on everything we do. We've been doing this now for over 30 years. You know, we wear masks, we wear gloves, we wear eye protection. We wipe down our countertops with high-level disinfectant. We sterilize our instruments. So patients should not be afraid to come to the dentist, especially if they have a toothache. They definitely need to be treated and, you know, be sure that they're not in pain, that the infection that they may have doesn't spread, you know, and cause further problems. And relying on hospital emergency rooms is not a good model right now because they're overwhelmed, I'm sure, with the fear of coronavirus and everything else that's going on in emergency rooms. And so we can't overburden our emergency rooms with dental emergencies. So patients definitely should seek care. And, you know, for low-income patients, they need to look to see if there's any federally qualified health clinics or hospital dental clinics that may be available to see them on an emergency basis. The ADA is saying we should definitely continue seeing emergencies and treating emergencies so that things don't get worse for the patients and for the hospitals. But so certainly patients definitely need to continue to seek and feel safe that they're in an environment. I had a patient this morning says, I'm just so comfortable coming here because of all the things you guys do to make sure that, you know, we're keeping our patients safe and our families.
Well, that's a good thing when you have the confidence of your patients. We did have a caller comment who says, it's not the dentist's office that we're worried about. It's the waiting room that's the problem. What about that?
Right. So that's a great question. We are actually promoting to our members a way of creating social distancing. And one of the recommendations that we're having is that when a patient arrives to the parking lot of the office, that they call us. And we will make sure that the room that we're treating them in is cleared, disinfected, and we will ask them to come straight from the door right into the treatment room. At the end of the appointment, our receptionist can come back to the treatment room and check them out, do their appointment scheduling and collect payments, et cetera, process their insurance, and the patient can walk straight out of the door without having to wait in the waiting room. We're asking patients to come without caregivers. Obviously, if a child is coming, we want the parent there. They're, you know, certainly asked to bring have the parent come into the waiting room or into the treatment room. But if they have a number of siblings, especially with the schools out now, we're saying maybe we should just reschedule the appointment so that there's not a crowded waiting room. you know, if a husband and wife comes and the husband's being treated, the wife probably shouldn't wait in the waiting room. She should probably go out to the car, and we'll call when the appointment's over. So those are the procedures that we're trying to place to create less of a crowded environment in our waiting rooms.
You gave the example of HIV in the early 80s, which was transmitted by bodily fluids.
Right.
This case, and I don't really want to compare this to the flu because a number of people have done that, and to try to downgrade or show that it's not as serious as what everyone is saying.
Right.
But at the same time, I mean, it is, as the CDC has said, 10 times more infectious than influenza. But in a normal influenza case, how do you treat a patient if a patient comes in with a cold or a patient comes in with the flu, coughing, sneezing, that kind of thing?
You know, 99% of the time, patients will call us up and say, "Listen, I've got a bad cough, I've got a flu, I've got bronchitis. You know, can I delay my treatment?" And absolutely, we do. You know, we've not had fortunately in my office, I've not had to deal with anybody with an emergency who's been that ill. But the safest bet there is to definitely stay home. And I'm telling my staff as well, if you have a cough or fever, any upper respiratory infection signs, stay home and be safe. So that's what we're doing with our patients. Again, for an emergency, you know, we haven't dealt with that there. My recommendation would be to call the office, and we would see if we could get them into possibly an oral surgeon's office or, you know, another place where it's a little bit more easily treat those patients.
The dentist who called last week, Dr. David Black, has called back to say his practice has decided to postpone appointments for 2 weeks and reevaluate as more information becomes available.
Right.
This almost sounds like on a practice-per-practice basis, the dentists are going to have to decide what they're doing.
You know, exactly right. When the Virginia Dental Association informed their members that they should shut down, I got a lot of calls and emails and texts over the weekend asking what we should do. And I told members that they should really make that individual decision for their own practice. You know, if they feel that they cannot provide the level of infection control that they would, you know, or if they feel that those level of infection control is not sufficient for their practice, then perhaps they should shut down. Again, I'm trying to personally manage my practice in the ways that we talked about. We're spreading appointments apart. We're trying to condense the schedule so that we're, maybe working a half day instead of a full day. But we're trying to create space between patients and such like that. And I'm trying to continue to practice as much as I can normally. You know, again, we're also asking patients when they come in, you know, do you have a cough? Have you had a fever? Have you traveled outside the country? Have you been on a cruise? You know, we're making hand sanitizer available in our waiting room, and you know, we're just doing all kinds of more disinfecting of doorknobs and chairs and everything that we touch that a patient could touch. So, again, in my own practice, I'm trying to maintain some sense of normalcy, but certainly any member dentist who feels that they would like to close down, that should be their individual decision. And again, hoping some sort of economic stimulus comes by so that we can continue to pay our staffs for such.
Now, Doctor, you said that you were seeking guidelines from the American Dental Association. What about the state? What has this? Has the Department of Health been in contact, provided any kind of advice, guidelines, regulations for Pennsylvania dentists?
Not right now. I know when Governor Wolf declared yesterday that businesses, non-essential businesses, shut down, he did say that medical offices, and we consider ourselves part of medicine. I've reached out to the dental director of the Department of Health, and I know she's probably very, very busy right now and dealing with a lot of things, so I haven't heard directly back from her, but I did reach out to her to see if we have any guidance from the state as well.
So, Doctor, just to wrap up here, advice that you would give to those who may have a dental problem or maybe thinking about whether to cancel an appointment or not.
Right. So the best thing a patient can do is to, you know, talk to their family members, make an individual decision as to how comfortable they feel with the dental office that they're in. Call the dental office and discuss with them, you know, what kind of protocols they're putting into place. Again, are there availability of social distancing? Is the infection control procedures that the office used those that are recommended by the CDC? You know, and we're not penalizing any patient that feels uncomfortable coming in. If they feel that they want to delay their appointment, we're certainly accommodating them. You know, sometimes it's difficult because our routine cleaning appointments are booked out 6 months, and we're telling patients that we will just try to get back to them as soon as we have openings, but, you know, it might be a couple of months or so before we want to get them back in right away. So it really has to be a decision based on how comfortable they are with their own practices that they're going to.
Dr. Charles Incalcaterra is president of the Pennsylvania Dental Association. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, and I hope everybody stays calm and stays safe.
Thank you very much. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Well, I have an update for you, and folks, as I said earlier, this is live radio, and there was a lot going on behind the scenes, and we're doing our best to keep you informed. The White House has moved that briefing by President Trump back to 11:30 a.m. this morning. Originally, it was supposed to be 10:30, but it has now been moved back to 11:30. WITF and NPR will have live coverage coming up at 11:30, so stay tuned to find out what the president has to say. Again, I think that from everything that we've been told, that this has to do with an economic stimulus package that has been proposed and the president supports. It is now coming up at 11:30. Okay, moving back into our coverage of the coronavirus. A Carlisle College student has tested positive for COVID-19, the coronavirus, after a spring break trip to Spain. Dominic from Cumberland County joins us on the phone right now, along with his mother, Trina. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, Dominic, I'm going to start with you. And we're just going to go by first names here. But you are a student at the University of Pennsylvania. You're 21. You went to Spain. Tell me about that. How did that come to be?
Well, it's kind of been in the books for a while. It was our spring break. Last year we went to Punta Cana, and we thought this year we might as well take a Euro trip with a bunch of my friends. So we booked it a couple months before. And the week before, I mean, coronavirus was definitely on the radar, but we thought, you know, just be careful. If anything happens, hopefully it would be okay. Had a good time, did a lot of sightseeing there with my friends. And then I was planning on leaving this past Saturday to head back, but on Wednesday our university sent out the email saying that classes have been postponed and they will now be online. And then the statement from Trump basically saying that there's going to be a travel ban put us all in a frenzy, buying tickets or upgrading tickets to get back that next day.
What day was that?
This was Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
I don't know what time it was here, but it was about 3 in the morning in Barcelona. We were just kind of glued to the TV watching Trump say that we might not be able to come back. So scary.
While you were in Spain, I mean, it's just been within the last few days that that coronavirus has exploded in Spain. You said that you were aware of it, but you were trying to be careful. When you say you were aware of it, what was it like in Spain? Were people talking about it? Did you see signs that were warning? Were people being told to stay indoors? Just what?
No, honestly, the part we were in was in Barcelona. So the majority of cases, most of the cases were in Madrid, and in Barcelona, it really didn't seem like it was an issue. I've learned later that it seemed like they were underreporting and not testing the way they should have been. But when we went there, all I knew is there was one confirmed case, and that was more than most places. In Philadelphia, there was already 4 cases. So it just wasn't really on the mind. You know, people were washing their hands. We kind of talked as a group to make sure you're not sharing drinks with strangers and kind of, you know, being hygienic, normal flu and cold season things. But there was nothing of a panic or anything until that Wednesday when the ban came up and they started reporting more accurately in Barcelona.
Throughout this conversation, I may ask you how you felt physically during different time periods. That Wednesday when you came back to the United States, how did you feel?
Well, I honestly felt fine. I had a little bit of a sore throat, but I kind of attributed that to being on a plane for 10 hours with all the dry air, and I had heartburn too, which I get most of the time. So And it wasn't really on my mind because no one was sick in our group. No one had any symptoms. My friends were aware that we were in Barcelona, but like I said, that there was really no talk. There was a panic where we were at, and we were even right outside the city. So we thought even if something happened in Barcelona, that we were kind of in the suburbs, a spot that maybe was a little more safe.
So when you got back to the United States, what did you experience?
Well, that was the thing. So I had a direct flight from Barcelona to the JFK airport in New York City. And obviously, since I was abroad, I had to go through customs. And there was a two-hour wait to even get through customs. And I thought maybe that was because they were doing screening, fever tests, and stuff like that. But it really was just because so many people were fleeing Europe because of this travel ban. I went up to customs. The man looked at me, gave me a nod, stamped my passport, didn't even ask any questions. And then I was in the country. It seemed as if there were just so many people in these tight lines that they were just trying to get everyone through. But there was no sort of testing, questioning. I mean, I assume he saw that I was in Barcelona based on the stamps in my passport, but not a question from customs.
And that was less than a week ago.
Yes, this was on Thursday when I landed.
Mm. So how did you get back to Carlisle?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I took public transportation in New York City to get to the mega bus, which travels back down to Philadelphia, because basically our university said by Tuesday we had to be out of there. They were closing everything and all my stuff, my laptop, my books, and everything I needed to do classes online and all my clothes were in Philadelphia.
Yeah, you go to Penn. You go to the University of Pennsylvania, right?
Exactly, right. Philadelphia, the city. So I took the bus down to Philadelphia to 30th Street, and then I went to my fraternity house where I live and started, packing up my things, getting ready, figuring out what's going on. I spent some time with my girlfriend, and we were being cautious, but no one had any symptoms. I felt fine. I had this sore throat, but wasn't thinking corona at all, especially because at the time I didn't know there were any more than one cases in Barcelona because that was the information I had. And then on Sunday, my parents came to pick me up and move me out, essentially, because that's what was happening in my campus. And I get a message from my friend who's in Chile, because that's where he's from, saying that he just tested positive for coronavirus. And this was Sunday.
And you had been around him?
I was around him. I mean, he lived with me in the Airbnb we stayed in Barcelona. But when the travel ban happened, and our university said that they're doing classes online, he decided to go straight from Barcelona to Chile because that's where he lives and that's where his family's from.
So how did you feel at that? How did you feel at that time?
At that point, that's when I started thinking: Is this sore throat? This disease? I thought maybe my allergies were acting up because I was a little bit congested. But like again, it's allergy season, and I have it back in the States. But then when he said he tested positive, I started connecting the dots and thinking, there's probably a good chance that I have it. So after my parents moved everything into the car, we went straight home and started calling people to figure out where I can get tested, and it was difficult.
So Trina, let me bring you in at this point. You're Dominic's mother. You started making these calls to find out where you can be tested. First of all, what's your as a parent, during this whole thing that you're hearing so much about here in the United States, what was your reaction to your son telling you that his friend in Chile has tested positive for the coronavirus?
Well, I think at that point we all started thinking, wow, panic situation. We need to get him tested right away.
So what did you do?
He said he was showing some slight symptoms. Well, as soon as we got him loaded up and got in the car, we knew we had over a two-hour drive back to Carlisle, so we started calling the hospital to see, can we take him right to the hospital to be tested? They advised us to call PA Health. So I called PA Health.
You're talking about the Department of Health?
Yes, yeah. Pennsylvania mm-hmm. Department of Health, yep. Mm-hmm. So made the first phone call to them in the car on the way home, and they said within an hour someone would call back. They did call back, but my phone didn't ring, so it went straight to voicemail. And they left this crazy voicemail saying, "Hi, this is the Department of Health returning your call. If you have any questions, you can call us at whatever, PA Health. So, which we tried again. I ended up making 3 phone calls on the way home to PA Health to try to get a hold of someone. We got home. We still didn't know what to do. We felt there was an urgency to get him tested. We ended up calling 2 more hospitals, our family doctor, and then ultimately, from what we were told by other hospitals, we found there was a hospital that they said was testing in the area. So we, after being home for maybe 20 minutes, we got in the car and drove to the hospital to try to get him tested.
What hospital was that?
Pinnacle Harrisburg Hospital.
So you drove to Harrisburg. Why didn't you go to Carlisle Hospital?
Because Carlisle said that they were not testing, that only the larger hospitals were testing. So
okay.
They're the ones that directed us to go to Harrisburg Hospital.
So you go to Harrisburg Hospital, what happens?
We walked into the emergency room. We were standing back a little bit from the desk, and the first thing I said to the lady was, before we start to tell them anything, could we get masks? And they just kind of halted us and said, have you been out of the country? And I said, yes, and they just shoved us out the door.
Did they give you any advice as they, I mean, I'm assuming you're talking about, you know, when you say shoving out the door, that it wasn't a physical shove out the door, but told you to go outside.
Well, actually, the nurse came behind the counter wearing a mask, and she kind of pushed us out the door with her and made us stand far away from the emergency room door outside. And within a couple minutes, she came back out and immediately put masks on both of us. And
did you call?
Then finally escorted us back into the emergency room.
Did you call Harrisburg Hospital beforehand?
We did not.
Okay.
We were advised by our family doctor to just get there.
Yeah. See, that's in the days since. This was Thursday, right?
This was Sunday, actually.
Oh, it was Sunday. Okay. So in the days since, I mean, we've heard from doctors to call ahead, even emergency rooms, because
right.
Exactly what you experienced.
That's what I had done at the car. That's what I was doing with the Carlisle.
Right,
hospital,
yeah.
Thinking we're not going to show up there. And they were just saying, no, go there, go here. So we said, okay, we'll go there.
Yeah. So what happened after you went to Harrisburg Hospital, and when did Dominic finally get tested?
We were there for several hours in a quarantine room. The doctor came in once or twice, and then at that point they stopped coming in. They just communicated with us through a telephone. We were there for several hours. I think it was about midnight that they finally decided to test him. The doctor at the hospital was confused why we went there. He was confused why we were being told to go to the Harrisburg Hospital, because that was not a protocol that they had been familiar with. I was actually under the impression that we may have been the first person coming in there like that.
Mm. It sounds like that even the healthcare professionals that, as you said, the protocol, that they were still getting everything together at that point, too. So
right.
The test occurs, and then what?
The test finally occurred. The doctor had to make 3 different phone calls before they were even willing to test him. Obviously, Dominic checked off all the boxes that needed to be checked off to get a test, in my opinion. But they were, at first, they were just happy saying, yeah, you probably have it, and we're going to send you home. And we kind of demanded a little more, like, you know, if you can't give us a test, tell us where to go to get a test. We need to know whether he has this or not. And the doctor was in communication with the Pennsylvania Department of Health, the CDC, and then another colleague of his in infectious diseases. So he was on the phone with 3 different people getting all different advice from them. So ultimately he decided, or somebody decided, yes, go ahead and test him.
And how long did it take before you had the results?
We just found out this morning. They just called this morning.
So it was 2 days ago that the test occurred, but it was assumed that he had tested positive. It was assumed that he had the coronavirus, right?
He was what they call presumed positive.
But it was...
The test had not come back, but they said they were calling him presumed.
So it was confirmed this morning.
Yes, correct. Okay.
So, Dominic, again, I'm going to ask you the question I'd asked you before. How are you feeling over the few days physically while this is all going on?
Well, you know, that's the thing. Physically, this feels just like a typical cold. I was not joking, but kind of thing. It's interesting. If I felt like this during the normal school year flu season, I don't even know if I would pop an Advil or go see any medical attention. I don't have a fever. I have a little bit of a cough, a dry cough. Every 40 minutes, maybe I'll shoot off a cough. And I'm a little congested, but other than that, I'm feeling pretty well. Like I said, it's like a common cold. I've gotten the flu before, and it was much worse than this. Now, obviously, my case may be different than other people, and especially different age groups, but I'm feeling pretty well.
Hmm. I understand both Dominic and Trina that you were on the phone for about an hour this morning with the Pennsylvania Department of Health getting instructions. What did you learn?
Well, so really it was more of an interview because I was in Philadelphia and had contact with so many people, and I was on a trip with a group of 12 other kids. He wanted to get all their information, where they're staying, their numbers, just to kind of track to see what's going on. I kind of walked them through what my days looked like leading up to me getting tested. And he took down my parents' information and my brother. And basically the advice he had was quarantine until your symptoms stop. And then also, which was new for me, I thought it was just 14 days when symptoms start. He said when the symptoms end, you should probably stay isolated for another 14 days. Which is something new that I learned.
So how are you staying isolated?
Well, I'm in my room, spend most of my time there. My parents have already decided, under the advice of them, that they're going to quarantine themselves also. So, I mean, I'll go out to the living room if I need to get something. I have a mask on, which is nice. I wash my hands, it seems like, every 20 minutes. They're getting bone dry from all the soap. But, yeah.
Trina, what are you doing? You have other kids?
We do. I have another son that's 19. I have actually two masks that Dominic and I got from the hospital that we have been wearing. I mean, I'm obviously, we're stuck here, and I'm having to make breakfast, lunch, and dinner for four people. So I'm wearing the mask. I'm washing my hands. We're trying to not sit near each other. All of us, we're trying to stay away from each other. Because my husband and I, even though we were with Dominic, we don't have symptoms. So there is a chance that we could not get this from him. So we're all trying to live in the same house, but stay away from each other.
You say you don't have symptoms, but was there any advice that you should get tested anyway because you were in contact with someone who does?
I asked that, and we were told that if we show symptoms, that yes, we will need to get tested at that point.
Mm. We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank both of you, Dominic and Trina, for being with us today. So what going forward, other than being isolated, actually quarantine, what do you anticipate?
Well, personally, I think that I'm going to get over this pretty quickly. Like I said, I've yet to have a fever. I'm feeling a little better today than I did yesterday. So I think there's a strong chance that I'm going to get over this, and then I have to rightfully just quarantine, even though I feel very healthy for the rest of the 14 days. But I'm pretty optimistic.
Trina, what about you?
Well, after talking to the gentleman this morning, I'm hoping that the rest of us don't get this. So I think it's really important right now just to try to keep our distance from Dominic, wash hands, and maybe we can get away from this thing with with no symptoms for the rest of us.
Dominic and Trina, thank you very much for telling your story. And I tell you, it's a harrowing account. I mean, we hear the numbers, but hearing it from personally really has an impact. Thank both of you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
And good luck to both of you. I'll tell you what, that really brings it home. Now, you know, Dominic, 21, he's not in the high-risk group, but we'll continue our coronavirus coverage tomorrow.